Glass Bagley Foundation Literature Festival 2016. My name is Jemima Steinfeld and I run the literature programme here, of which our festival is the annual highlight. It's been sponsored by the Bagley Foundation for the last 3 years and I want to thank them for their support. So welcome to our night that is going to spotlight short stories. Tonight we will discuss how some of the fantastic short stories have come about, the lives they have chronicled, and just generally get more into the work of these three really great writers. There'll be readings, and hopefully you'll walk away with a sense of exactly what their writing is like. So our panel features Priti Taneja, an academic and activist who was the BBC Radio 3 New Generation thinker, in the middle. Her novella, Kumkum Malhotra, my pronunciation is not great, won the Gatehouse Press New Fiction Prize 2014-2015, and it's also been nominated for a Saboteur Award, which is a win by public vote award. So if you want to go onto the site and vote, that's always welcome. We also have Jonathan Tell, a writer who has written on Israel-Palestine, China, currently researching Syrians in Germany. He was the winner of the 2015 Commonwealth Short Story Prize, the V.S. Pritchett Prize 2015 from the Royal Society of Literature, and the Sunday Times EFG Short Story Award, the first ever Brit, I think, to win that award, if I'm right, for his short story, The Human Phonograph. Finally, there is Mahesh Rao, who is from Nairobi, Kenya, and is currently living in Mysore for most of the year, England 3 months. Mahesh is a former lawyer, academic researcher, and a bookseller, and now, of course, a writer. His book, The Smoke is Rising, was the winner of the Tata First Book Award for Fiction, and he has a critically acclaimed collection of short stories entitled 1.2 Billion. So the kind of the format of tonight is all three of them are going to tell us a little bit more about their work. I might ask one or two questions at the start, and then later on we'll open it up to the floor for questions. So please join me in giving all three a warm welcome. So, Priti, maybe we could start with yours. You base your story around a kind of tightly knit domestic scene that spans the 1980s and the 1990s of India. Maybe you, just tell us a little bit about that and how also within the kind of words you do span this time and what it was like fitting that into the workout.
Well, it's a novella. It's a very short book and it's called Kumkum Malhotra. And there's a few things I think I should start by saying. I really wanted to set out to focus really tightly on a very specific moment of economic change in India, which we're seeing the fruition of now. And I think in some of your stories, we really see what that's become. But at the time, it was really to do with how slowly, detail by detail, the West was sort of being introduced into middle class and lower middle class lives in Delhi. And for me, I grew up kind of between here and there, going back and forward to my father's house where he grew up in Nizamuddin, which is a very specific part of the city. And sort of we were the kind of carriers of things from here, because it was a very closed economy. You couldn't buy sort of Marks and Spencer's underwear, for example. We used to take suitcases full of biscuits and goods that one couldn't easily get in India, bras, underwire bras, pants, and things which just began to be those desirable things that said about a household that, you know, there were foreign relatives, there were people who had left India and they were coming back to visit. But the story itself is actually focused around one woman who didn't leave. And for her, she's trying to deal with the pressures of being a wife and being a mother and trying to negotiate those relationships within her own family. I really wanted to have a story which does something very, very different from the big novels about India, the Rushdie novels, and even Naipaul, who's a kind of writing hero of mine, where women talk to women, where women relationships with women have to be really looked at from a kind of empathy and a kind of way of understanding that while there is competitiveness there, there is a really very specific kind of intimacy as well. So it's a tough job to do that in a very short book. But to do that, I guess I had a few forerunners, which I took quite seriously. And one of those was, I think, the novels of Jean Rhys, who's a modernist writer, who really cared a lot about these female characters who either were very, very still points in their domestic settings, or they had these itinerant natures and they just travelled in circles around places, being outsiders, walking the cities, and touching on lives as they went. So the other thing that Jean Rhys does very, very beautifully in her early novels, which are all set in sort of Paris, is she really examines the construction of female identity, how women get ready every day, how they look at themselves in mirrors, how they look at themselves in windows, or look at other women. And it's very rare to read that in contemporary fiction, I think. So that's one of the things that really mattered to me to do. Jemima's asked us to kind of give you a taster of what's in our book. So I'm going to read you just the opening section of the novel. And I hope that you can see some of the things that I've been talking about in the piece. From her window, Kumkum can see baby Madhu on the swing and Nanni running in circles with her dolly in her hand. Up and down and round and round. Since Madhu arrived, they play like this, one circling the other like sun and earth. Madhu is smiling. That is good. That means she is enjoying. She is safe. But how many times has she told Nanni not to run? The mitti is dry in the yard. If she falls, she will cry. Worse, she will tear her salwar, and there is no time for such accidents tonight. Where is Ashish? Kumkum stands on tiptoe in her blouse and petticoat, using the thin cotton curtain as a sari. Ashish and his gang are huddled in the outer corner as if they are making a secret. She cranes and twists, but cannot see. It is nothing. She must dress. She forgets the children and turns with the dust motes caught in the late light back to herself in the full-length mirror and her preparations for the evening ahead. 1, 2. With what careful balance she slips each foot into its high-heeled sandal. Tonight the family will be together for the first time in 3 years. 3 brothers, 3 wives, 3 children. As the wife of Shalu, middle brother, Kumkum wants to look her best. As the wife of Shalu, the middle brother whose business is failing, she wants it particularly. She puts 4 hair grips, black-ridged and designed to be invisible between her lips, raises her arms and winds her hair up and back, securing it with jabs. Once, the dinner will be at Raviji and Simaji's house. Twice, she and Shalu have not been invited to visit them for so long. Thrice, even so, the distance between the houses is no more than the diameter of New Delhi. The fourth is not needed. She places it back into its compartment in the drawer. From the top of the cupboard, she takes her mother's wooden jewellery box. There are 3 pieces inside. She makes a pain face as she screws in her grandmother's diamond studs. They glint in her ears, 2 bright chips of stars. She fastens her 1 necklace, her wedding Mangal Sutra. She closes the lid on her Dadaji's old watch, strap, frayed, but face and hands always ready for business, and stores the box away. She leans into the mirror to paint lipstick. It smells of old roses and wax. This was a gift from Simaji 2 years back and has not ever been used. Her hand is unsteady with the shape of it. She has to wipe off the colour and do it again. She leans forwards and must brace her hips on the edge of the dresser. She knocks her powder and a white cloud puffs into the air, then settles, turning her brown skin grey. The scrunched, spent tubes of fair and lovely lie on her table with her brush, her rollers and her polish, her nail scissors still caught with hairs from Shalu's beard. She will have to clean this before she goes out. So that's Kumkum getting ready for her evening with her family, something happens just after that, which kind of changes her life forever. Everything starts to unravel. And then into her life comes a Westerner, another woman called Anya, who the researcher who kind of came from me because I grew up here and also came from, you know, not being white and not being blonde and not being a white Western woman. So, and having that experience of otherness, but also knowing what it's like to go to India and being the Western one. I'm not sure if we've got any more time. But.
Well, I'm just curious because do you feel that women have been missed out in Indian storytelling up until now?
I wouldn't say that, no. I think that there are some brilliant women writers who are writing in India. K.R. Meera, she's a South Indian writer, Malayalam, whose work gets translated. And she, again, writes novellas as well as novels. It's one of her most astonishing works is called The Hangwoman, and it's a really blinding book about the daughter of a hangman who has to make a decision about whether she can take a life. Her novellas kind of look at rape, they look at memory, they look at historical memory, and they look at the kind of oral storytelling that's passed down woman to woman. You know, for me, we're talking about lost lives here, but my first kind of real experience of what that might mean in India came from Urvashi Bhutalia, who started a publishing company called Kali for Women. And she, her book, The Other Side of Silence, which is probably somewhere in this room, looks at the stories of women who were killed by men from their own families during partition to stop them from being abducted by men of the other side. So Hindu men and Muslim men killing their own daughters and wives, or women committing suicide to stop them being abducted. And for me, that was the 1990s when I read that book. It came out, and it was such a shock to realise that these lost stories existed, and had been submerged under the surface. But they are there. They're being published in India. They don't necessarily make it here.
Okay. Well, I think since we're on the topic of India, I might pull in Mahesh, and you have lots of different stories, all kinds of different lives from, you know, the glitzy, glamorous winners, I suppose, quote unquote, to the less so. Do you have particular favourites or ones that you're drawn to?
I wouldn't say I have a particular favourite. Certainly the one that was easiest to write, and this is quite an alarming thing to have to say, it was the voice of a really spoiled, quite nasty, indulged teenage girl from Delhi. And this is a story that I wrote quickest, and it's, the voice seemed to come most naturally. And when that happened, it is quite alarming as a writer, because you think, this seems to be my voice. This is kind of, in some strange way, who I am. So, but it's certainly not my favourite. I mean, I think it is hard to pick a favourite, but I mean, the collection sort of happened by accident, because I was waiting for my novel to be published. It was in submission everywhere, and you know, these things take a long time, and the idea of starting a new novel was just kind of dreadful. And someone suggested, why don't you try short stories, which I've always loved, but never had the confidence to write. And so it was one of those things that I began to do and began to find them really addictive, you know. And so my only sort of note to myself was that each one should be as completely different as possible. And what then happened was that I found myself setting them in different parts of India, in different states, you know, exploring different voices from different social backgrounds. And so then I eventually ended up with these 13 stories, which are set in 13 different states. And sort of partway through the process, I think that became something that was by design. And I think the sessions have been called Asia's Forgotten Lives. So some of it was an attempt to try and to explore situations or scenarios that we don't see very often. I was very interested, particularly at one point, in the Naxal insurgency in India. So this isn't very widely known, but there is, and there continues to be, across, you know, hundreds of districts in India, what's loosely called a Maoist uprising, I suppose. So across various states, there are groups of people who are fighting the Indian state. It's a very violent situation. There are people being kidnapped, railways being blown up, lots of deaths. But this doesn't feed into the big kind of India shining story that we always hear. And one thing that I kind of read about peripherally in a news magazine was that there were these government militias that were also active. So it was a situation where these Naxal Maoist insurgents were fighting the state, but a state proxy. And the outcome of all of this was that tribal villagers who were in these regions were being displaced from their homes. So I was on YouTube one day, and I wondered if there was any footage of any of this stuff. And it turned out that someone had filmed in one of these detention camps. And it had something like 11 views or something. But it was footage of someone's phone trailing through a camp. And what was amazing was that these people had been displaced into this camp, and you don't really think about it, but of course life must go on as usual. Communities are displaced whole, so people who did form a village are now living elsewhere. But all the old rivalries, all the old loves, the hates, they must all continue. So in this footage, there were children playing in the long grass, there were women doing their washing, there were people laughing, there was a squabble over a cockfight. All of this stuff, and so one of the stories kind of came out of that, you know, you sort of imagining what must it be like to carry your loves, your hates, your desire for revenge, say, from a woman who stole your husband, into this completely different milieu. I'm going to read a bit in a bit. Another one of these stories came from a family anecdote, actually, and I can say this in a slightly more relaxed manner when I know that there's no member of my family present in the audience. But someone once told me about someone. I think she's possibly a fourth cousin or something, and she lived in a joint family situation, which is, you know, the sort of patriarch of the family, all the sons, their wives, all their children, all living in one big house, which is a situation you see less of in India these days, in urban India, but it's still quite prevalent in smaller towns. And the story went that she'd been in the bathroom. She was having a bath in the bathroom, and her father-in-law had been peeking at her through a window above the bathroom door. And this completely split the family, because half the family believed her and sort of decided, well, you know, he's always been a bit dodgy, you know, he's always looked like a bit of an old lech to me, and kind of, you know, sided with her. And then the other half were all like, well, I've never trusted her for a moment, you know, she's always been a bit of a hussy. And it was this kind of, you know, this sort of split. But that was very interesting to me, because I thought this must happen all the time in these joint family settings, where you have these older men with these younger women living at quite close proximity, and you know, kindness, friendship can easily be mistaken for something more, be it lust or love or anything like that. And so that's where this story came from. It's called The Agony of Leaves. And it's set in Kunur, which is a small town in the south of India, in the Nilgiri Hills. It's all tea country. It's where a lot of tea is grown. So this is The Agony of Leaves. I do not want to beat about this bush or that bush. I will say it straight. I am not a perverted fellow. It has never been my habit to move with prostitutes or other women of that type. Not even once have I made a lewd remark to a lady or suggested some dubious act to anyone other than my wife. I was always faithful to Lata, and she will certainly vouch for that wherever she's resting now. I am from a decent family. I have a good position in the community. I have clean hands. Unfortunately for me, I'm in love with my daughter-in-law. And without a doubt, it is love. It is necessary to say this to challenge the obvious conclusion that my predicament is a matter of lust and libido. The problem is society, which over and above everything else has a filthy mind. People will say, look at the dirty bugger, he has no shame, how could he even think such a thing? What I would say in response is this: look at my track record and my intentions, look at my character. After such an examination, only a clean chit can be the result. But it is my bad luck that things are not so simple. Every morning, Meera and I sit on the veranda with our coffee, just like Latha and I did the time we went to Kodaikanal. Mira scans the paper and I scan her, although not in a way that would make her feel uncomfortable. My son Vikram usually sleeps till late, so it is just the two of us. Mira rustles the paper and reads out some interesting tidbit. Principal absconds with student and college cook. Then she gives me a half smile and shakes her head in that special way. What will people do next? The smile that also means, what will we do next? Long after our second cup, when the paper has slid onto the floor, we continue to sit here staring at the slopes. There is no need for this type of attendance on her part or on mine, but we do it anyway, feeling something between thrill and anxiety. I really need to have my bath and start the day, she often says, not moving. The day is not going anywhere, I say. In a few weeks the rains will be here and the water will smash against every side of the bungalow. I suppose then we will have to go back inside. But I'm not going to think about that. At the moment the sunshine is still lighting up the hillsides, every tea bush aching with green. I have said that my feelings are not based on lust, and I maintain that position. But it has to be said that Mira is beautiful. At times, when she's lost in her own world, her face reminds me of one of those 50s tragedy queens. The expression is a little sulky. The determined chin is lowered. That loose strand is tucked behind her ear. Then our eyes will meet, and I will say something about the constant damn mist up here, and her spirit returns, the laughter springing out of her eyes. This week, her nail polish has been chipped. It makes her look a little bold, a little mischievous. I can imagine her hands pinning my wrists down as her hair falls over my face.
Jonathan, I'm going to bring you in now. China, I think one of the things that's so interesting, obviously, about anyone writing within the realm of China is the moment you might assume that it's the big anniversary of the Cultural Revolution and it's not really being talked about there, and there is censorship and there is so much suppression of material. And also as a writer, it can be quite precarious what you write, and you never know whether you're kind of going into one of those sensitive areas. So how did you get involved, and what has been your experience of these kind of big themes?
China is fascinating for so many reasons. What's going on now and within living memory is fascinating, but also it has thousands of years of history, and people in China are very much connected to that. And when some scandal happens involving, say, a contemporary politician, they'll say, oh yes, that's like something that happened in the reign of some emperor thousands of years ago. So people do have a way of understanding history, including the Cultural Revolution, in a very much in the grand scheme of things. There are certain things that are not talked about in China, and there are certain things that are talked about in some ways. So the Cultural Revolution is talked about quite a lot. What's not talked about is the Tiananmen massacre, or whatever you want to call it, Tiananmen events, as they say. And you can't talk about Tibet but the Cultural Revolution, there's quite a lot has actually been published within China in Chinese. Now, as my perspective as a foreigner coming there, one of the things it sort of gives, I do feel I'm not Chinese. I do have some family connection with China, but I do think it is possible to understand another culture if you have to be both slightly. They're not arrogant, but whatever it is, confident or something, and also very humble too. You have to be aware of how much you don't understand, and then use the imagination and see how far that will take you. So I did. I'll tell you, when I first decided, I've been in China a number of times, but it was in 2007 that I first thought maybe I can actually write about China. And I spent most of the year there, and I talked to many people, made many notes. And at the end of that time, I didn't know what I was going to write. I just knew, but I knew two things. Firstly, I knew it would be about Chinese in China. It wouldn't be about foreigner goes to China. It wouldn't be about China abroad.
Which
Chinese
person
abroad.
The main thing, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, Chinese.
So many foreigners,
yeah.
Right there.
Foreigners do that. Foreigner goes to China or foreigner goes to India. It's not. I mean, it can be interesting, but it's not interesting to me, at least. And I think one of the things I love writing and doing about fiction is indeed getting into the heads of people who are not like myself. I mean, I spend far too much time being myself, but trying to be somebody else for a change. And I also actually knew that it would be based in Beijing, the big city, the capital. I guess I'm from London, the big capital. I've always lived in big cities. And Beijing is the centre of the world. It's the most important place. Ask anybody in Beijing, they will tell you this, that it's just so obviously a centre of the world, it's not even worth arguing about the point. Just as people in London thought that once upon a time, you know, and maybe not now. And that makes it really interesting. And then I made a deliberate decision to try and talk about a cross-section of people, so from the very rich to the very poor, and people in the middle too, and people who are born in Beijing, people who come migrants from the provinces, you know, young and old, all different situations. And I actually published a book of short stories, and then I decided to write another book of short stories about them. This one will actually have somewhat focus on financial corruption in China. And what links all the stories together, there is one central character who is he eventually becomes a billionaire, a corrupt banker, and everybody is connected to him by some degrees of separation. But that includes, indeed, people from the very poorest people, the very poorest migrant worker, up, indeed, to billionaires and politicians. And, you know, that was interesting, trying to find those connections. And for the research for that, well, a lot of it was just going up to anybody I met in China and saying, you know, in your line of work, you ever come across any financial corruptions? And the response is always the same. They always laughed and said yes, and they would tell me stories. None of which I use, because the way I write fiction is I talk to people and get their stories and do that into my subconscious, and then I make up my own stories. So I did actually what I've written is basically a book of linked stories. A couple of the stories are actually set during the Cultural Revolution, which somehow connected to the modern world. So, you know, one of that is an old man who was like a beggar on the streets, and he had a particularly horrific story of his what happened to him during the Cultural Revolution. And another one is about one that just won a big prize for me. It's actually set during the Chinese, when they built their nuclear bomb, they had the equivalent of the Manhattan Project, which is set in the far northwest of China. And it's about a woman who goes there as actually the librarian there, and she has a tragic romance, and she, and also the indigenous people of that part of China somehow enter the story. They're sitting on the periphery of the story, singing erotic folk song. And I got research for that was, partly just listening to the erotic folk song, actually, and finding as much as I could about that. And then as I imagine that song being sung around, that sort of was the music in the background of the story. But the story, I thought I'd read one, and this is something, I thought I'd pick this one because it's something people don't talk about much. The story, the title of the story sort of gives it away. It's called The Average Person in China. And I thought, people don't talk about the average person. People talk, even, who's the average person in London? Who knows? If I were to say, you know, let's go go to the library or go to the bookstore and find a story about people in London, it might be about the rich or celebrities, it might be about the very poorest, homeless people on the streets. But what about the sort of, you know, the people who are just most average, people who work in an office and do a not very, you know, kind of boring job, and, you know, they're not dirt poor, they don't get paid much, and nothing big, you know, that grand happens in their lives. What about them, I thought? And since the story is about financial corruption, that is going to impinge on the life of the hero of the story. So I will just find it, because I have a computer turns to get this on. Okay, here we are. So what do you need to know? So you need to know he is a junior civil servant in a small provincial city. His job is a statistician. And he's invited to a conference in Beijing, and he's very excited to be there, you know. And in the same, that very same conference building, there is another conference of top bankers and politicians and civil servants. And so these are two groups, and something interesting is about to happen to him. He has got slightly lost in the building, and he's wandered in and found some sort of room. Okay, here goes. And his name is Luo, by the way. There is a cup filled with tea on the table, and Luo drinks from it unthinkingly. He is aware somebody else is in the room, and realizing the tea isn't his, puts the cup down with a clatter. A woman in a dark business suit is in the far corner. She is about his own age, pale-skinned, with eyes that make him think of a nocturnal mammal. She shrinks back. It seems she is afraid of him, or of something. Hello, he says, nudging the tray aside, as if originally he touched the tea things only in order to clear space. Excuse me, she whispers. Can I help you? Ah, Mr. Seaman, what time is overview of the financial health of the banking sector? The programme for this event is right in front of him. At 2:15, he says, and actually I'm not... Where is it taking place? In the Shanghai room on the second floor. But actually I'm not... Her lips quiver. He can smell her osmanthus perfume. She skims over to him in quick little swaying steps. Tears are glowing in her large eyes. Please, please, Mr. Seaman, whatever you do, don't promote Yang. Her blazing passion makes everything around her, including himself, seem by contrast dim. No, but, he stammers. She approaches, the cloud of her perfume incorporating him, and stretches forth an arm. He feels her electric touch. Something is transferred from her hand to his. Before he can say a word, she retreats, and with one final sob, she vanishes from the room. It is as if he dreamed her, but in his hand is a red envelope, which he opens. Behold, a stash of 100 yuan banknotes, more money than he has ever seen in his entire life. He cannot move. The fact of the money, the substance and the glory petrifies him. He has the sensation he is tasting the money. The money is crammed in his mouth, pressed against his teeth, making his gums itch. He shudders. He forces himself to think realistically. This isn't just money, just tinted engraved paper. He holds the envelope against his chest. It is not the normal red cash envelope you might give somebody for spring festival. It is hefty, dense. It could almost contain the manuscript for a novel. His heart beats fast. The red envelope throbs in his pocket. He leans against the doorframe. He pants and wipes his forehead with his sleeve, and he feels like sobbing himself. He returns the way he came. Soon, down in the atrium, he is filled with a quiet joy. Over there in the corner, some of his fellow statisticians are chattering away. He smiles at them. He is connected to their world, but also now to the world of money. He feels wise. Rather as when in middle school he first learned about sex, he looked at every married person and thought, he's done that with her, she's done that with him. So now, looking at every banker, he thinks, he gives bribes, he takes bribes. Granted, there are exceptions. Honest, principled bankers and politicians, just as there are some adults who don't have sex. Luo notices a cleaner operating a floor-polishing machine, and he comprehends even a life like hers more profoundly. He is piqued at the hidden mechanism that makes China tick. If only we truly understood money, there is nothing we would not understand. And so he's now received, by mistake, this bribe, and he has to make a decision. Which way will his life go? And, read the story, you'll find out.
What made you choose corruption?
Partly because it's so omnipresent. Also because it's a way of, I suppose, of linking different people on different levels. Money is transferred, sex or something be, but money is transferred between people, so everybody is linked by it. And it's also, it's a one way of talking about the modernization of China as China developed. There was a time when this didn't exist. In time, during the Cultural Revolution, you had your assigned job for life, you had your standard of living. You couldn't, there was nothing you could do. If you had some money, there's nothing to spend it on. But China has changed hugely. But yet it hasn't changed, but the way, all the same, it's been a way connected to China's past. Because there are stories of, this corrupt billionaire says, and he says to himself, that China has existed, corruption has existed in China thousands of years in the past. It will exist thousands of years in the future. He, says the corrupt billionaire, he can't take praise or blame for his own corruption. It's just part of the way humans are. And I'll tell you a joke, which is a thousands of years old joke, which I still found funny. So there's this man, and he's walking along in China, and he goes by the sort of Buddhist temple, and he feels the need to pee. So he pees right there in front of the temple, and he is caught. And he goes before the judge, and the judge gives him a fine, which is equal to two coins of silver, which is equivalent to actually half one coin of gold. And all he's got on him, he's got one coin of gold, which is twice the value. So he goes to the judge and says, can I have change, please? And the judge says, go and pee there again tomorrow. Now that joke could be a joke from today's China. It could be a joke from India, I guess, too, maybe. But it is, in fact, a several thousand years old joke in China.
So you've done a lot of writing on China, but you now are looking at Syrians and Germany?
I'm looking at Syrians and other refugees on the way to Germany and elsewhere. That's my next project. because I do like moving around and trying to... Now, as always, you can't just go somewhere and say, I'm going to write about today. It requires a lot of research and a lot of understanding. I have lived in Germany, and actually I have a German family connection too. I have written a book, I've lived in Jerusalem, I've written about Palestinians, which gives me some sort of... Palestinians are not the same as Syrians, but there's some connection. So it's a lot of research, trying to talk to people, going to different places. So I was just in Berlin, I'll be going back there. I was just actually on the Greek island of Kos recently, doing some volunteering there. I'm off soon to Turkey, and then to back to Israel again, to go and look around and talk to people. And again, I'm trying to encompass as many different kinds of lives and different kinds of stories as I can. And I'm trying not to do what journalists do. There's a certain very limited... If you look at what journalist stories about the subject, there's only like three stories they write ever, with different names, with different names of places. But there's so many other things, sort of things to tell. And in particular, in order to write about what's going on now, I have to understand what's going on in the past. So I'm trying to understand what life was like for people before the current war. What was life back in Syria back, you know, 10, 20 years ago? And having also there's no such thing as a generic Syrian. They're all different, and they all have. You know, so I have to understand all the different religions and so on, and the different. And then I have to, of course, make up my imaginary characters.
Great. You two have both also, I know, you've got a book coming out soon. And you've obviously written the book, and you kind of explained briefly at the beginning how writing short stories was. You actually were pleasantly surprised by how they flowed. Could you two tell us a little bit about how you would kind of compare your writing process for the two?
Gosh, my book is called We That Are Young, and it's a rewriting of King Lear, and it's set in contemporary India. So it's coming out next year, probably in January, with Galley Beggar Press, who take on sort of very different kinds of writing. It's a small independent publisher based in Norwich. But because it's based on Shakespeare's King Lear, it's enormous compared to this tiny volume, which, and in this book, you sort of span a decade of, or two decades almost. There's pairs of female characters. There's Kumkum and Anya. There's Nunni and Madhu, their cousins. And they sort of reflect and repeat each other over time. You know, you go from Nunni's childhood right the way through to her wedding, and it's done in 10 to 12,000 words. Whereas the book is set over a few months, and it's, you know, 400 pages long. So the difference between the novella and the novel, firstly, that's kind of two different kinds of time, two different kinds of very different structures. But for me as a writer, what the two things that are connected here is trying to find ways of expressing different points of view within the same story. And never, for me, it's really important, and I think, if you don't mind me saying, your writing does this a lot too, where it just undermines this idea of exotic India, the lushness and the freshness and the dripping mangoes and the kind of all of these things, and in a line trying to kind of set up that expectation and then undercutting it with something that's deeply rotten. And, you know, you do that in a line, and I think that's what I've striven to do, because when I've been in India and I've worked with people on the ground there, talked in very similar ways, you know, to people from all walks of life in different parts of the country, you'll always get something that's very bittersweet, and often without the sweet, because life is tough there. It's a fight every day just to do the simplest thing, go from A to B, and I'm sure you can say a bit more about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, in terms of process, because I wrote my novel first, that's all I knew. I think it took about a year that you're sort of... it was the story of a city, so my head was teeming with characters, you know, and I didn't know any of the rules. I mean, I haven't done a creative writing course or any of these things, which I think in some way helped me, because I think I would have been terrified of all the rules had I been told, you must never introduce a character in chapter 9, which is, you know, in a 10-chapter book, which is kind of exactly what I did. But, you know, so I kind of broke all my own rules, And luckily, with the editorial process, a lot of that was fixed. But while I was writing it, there was a certain freedom, because my head was teeming with characters, and I had that scope of a year to kind of flesh everything out. And then when I started writing stories, it was a completely different process because you're constantly editing as you work in a way that I hadn't with the novel. You know, there is that sense of compression, intense compression, where you're sort of forcing yourself to look at every single word. And there's something also very liberating to know that in 3 or 4 weeks you're done, you know, and you can move on. I mean, the novel sort of felt at times like you were in this kind of long and difficult marriage where, you know, you just didn't know why you were carrying on, really. You're just sort of trudging from 1 month to the next. And then the short stories just felt like these kind of incredible, intense flings, one after the other, you know. And, you know, if it didn't work, you could drop the story halfway. You didn't feel you'd kind of committed to it and you had to push on. And so I'm supposed to be working on a novel now, but I just keep finding myself being drawn back to short stories because I love that intensity of working. And coming back to the bittersweet thing that you mentioned, I mean, what's incredible about, because I spend most of my time now in India, what's incredible about being there is that the stories find you. You don't actually have to go and look for them. I was speaking to someone who'd been on holiday in Norway recently, and they were saying to me that, you know, they just drove for miles and miles and didn't see a soul, and it was kind of amazing, which it would be, you know, particularly if you're sort of used to India, where you're constantly surrounded by people. But then I sort of thought, but you know, for a writer, I mean, of course, there are amazing writers from Norway, but for a writer, you have to work so much harder out there, I imagine, you know, because in India, you go out for a pint of milk and you will encounter 5 short stories on the way there and 5 on the way back. And it's partly to do with the density. You know, you're sort of at such close quarters with people. And if, like most writers, you're a constant eavesdropper, you know, this constant snatches of information and character that are kind of filtered through to you. And partly it's just there's so much potential for conflict all the time. I think there's this kind of low-lying aggression all the time that you feel, and I think for a writer that's really important to feel those frictions where things are rubbing up against each other. You know, even when you pick up a magazine. I mean, I just very randomly picked up a magazine that was talking about female preachers, Christian preachers in Punjab, who are going around converting local Sikh and Hindu communities to Christianity. And this was just a very small piece in a magazine. But, you know, just that those few words, it just threw up so much potential for conflict, for a relationship breakdown. Because I immediately thought, well, what does her husband think about this? You know, because, you know, if you're living in rural Punjab and you know what the kind of patriarchy that exists there is like, it's the first question that comes to you. You know, does she have a husband? You know, what does he think of this? And it immediately kind of got drawn into a story that is in the book. And this kind of thing just happens all the time. So it's a very rich place to be.
Mm. I think you're right. And I think this novella was written quite a lot drawing from my memories of my childhood home, my father's house and different family members and impressions that I had from being very young. But writing the novel, I sort of immersed myself for 6 months and travelled in India and lived in India. And that low-level aggression you describe is definitely there every day. It can, as a woman and even, you know, with friends, it was very, very difficult to do the simplest things without feeling like somehow someone somewhere was watching you or judging you or, you know, even within a girl group or and so on, with, you know, you go for a coffee, which is such a new phenomenon in Delhi. It's 20 years old, if that, you know. I remember going there when I was young, 15, 16, and we'd go and order cappuccino in some 5-star or something, which tells you a bit about the kind of life that I had access to then. And it would come looking like an espresso, because that sense of what things were, the language was rubbing up against realities. Ideas of the West and ideas of how we should be here were different from, you know, the way one would experience the same exact thing in a Western city. So
that sense of tension, which I agree with you, is absolutely to do with patriarchy.
I mean, you also go into, I mean, you can go into a smaller Starbucks in a smaller city today, and if you order an espresso, the baristas have been trained to tell you, you do know it doesn't come with milk.
Yeah.
Right. And then this kind of leads on, because if you consider yourself to be something of an urban sophisticate, you'll kind of pull yourself up to your entire, well, of course I know it doesn't come with milk, you know. And, you know, so it's visible all the time, this kind of jostling for position in a society, which, I don't want to say that, I don't want to make it too other, because that kind of jostling for position occurs in all societies, but it just plays out in slightly different ways.
I also think it's interesting when you talk about this character of the urban sophisticate, because there is also a sense, you know, which I felt coming back into India, that how dare it be so modern now? And I think I know a lot of people who go there from the West, either who are from the diaspora communities and they've grown up here, or friends who are English, and so on. And they go there and they see this air-conditioned airport. It's not crowded with people anymore like it used to be in the 90s. There are a line of taxis right outside, just like there is in New York. In fact, it's nicer than JFK because it's newer, you know. And there are flyovers, and there's a metro, and it's very cheap, and so on and so on. So there's infrastructure there that wasn't there before, that doesn't fit with this idea of India that's been sort of become a brand that one can go and experience as some kind of form of, you know, marigold eating or something, you know, which is...
Yeah, I mean, because also where I live is a bit of a yoga mecca, you know, Mysore in the south. It's sort of, I think Madonna and Sting washed up there at some point, and ever since then it's kind of become this, you know, this promised land. And so it's odd. You will overhear conversations with people who've you know, foreigners who've come there to study yoga, and you know they are literally along the lines of, but you know everything here is so pure, and you know they're poor, but there's a certain dignity to this kind of poverty. And I mean, these are sort of conversations that you might have expected to hear in the 60s, you know, when the Beatles were running around Rishikesh and stuff. But to find that, you know, that They're slightly different, but they're kind of an updated version of the same kind of conversation. Is odd.
It is odd
to me.
What kind of stereotypes do you fight against with all the writing that you do?
They are stereotypes, but I don't feel I'm not consciously trying to work against them. I'm simply trying to ignore them. I'm always trying to see China through Chinese eyes, not through the foreigner's eyes. And, I'll give an example of what I wrote to. There's a certain, I won't say the name, but a certain writer who writes for The New Yorker about China and knows a lot about it. Okay, never mind. But he was very proud of something. He wrote an article about how he uses photographs he writes non-fiction, but, and he has this photograph of a man he took, and he was very proud of the way, this particular man has a moustache, and the author, described the moustache as looking like botched calligraphy, and he's very proud of this little simile he made up. Now, number one, I thought, I don't like it because it's obviously chinoiserie or this calligraphy thing. Number two, which more to the point, this man didn't, from a Western perspective, this moustache might indeed look a bit sort of wispy and botched, but by Chinese standards, it was completely averagely bushy, averagely wispy. It wasn't botched at all. It was only from his Western perspective it seemed that way. So what I was thinking, I'm seeing at a construction site in Beijing, there was a whole lot of construction workers, and one of them had a moustache and none of the others did. So I asked Chinese friends of mine, I said, well, what do you think that would signify? If you saw one man being rather eccentric, what might... And they gave me different answers. And it's a very interesting question, actually, because you get very... I mean, any culture, what does it mean in London if somebody chooses... You know, I have a brother who has a moustache. I have three brothers, only one of them does. You know, never mind. But it's an interesting question. I mean, it could mean many different things to different people. But for me, I was trying to see from different Chinese perspectives what that signified, not from a foreigner's perspective.
What were some of the answers, Julia?
Well, some of the answers could have been, indeed, maybe it's where in China it comes from. He could be, if he's from the northwest, the part that's actually near Pakistan, that might well be what it signifies. But unlike in the case of construction workers, they probably all come, usually they all come from the same place, so probably not the case. There's also references in traditional sort of, you know, Beijing opera and so on, there's some characters who wear moustaches, and often they're the kind of the villain, so maybe he's... I'm not saying he's a villain, but maybe he's he must be some kind of eccentric, some kind of dandy. He must be rebelling in some little way or something. I mean, you get different answers people give. There's not like the white right answer. But I would, if I gave my fictional character, a moustache, I'd be trying to get inside. Why does he? What would it mean to him? What would it mean to other characters in the story, and so on?
I'm going to open it up now to the floor. Does anyone have questions?
Is anyone here a short story writer or a novel writer or a person who remembers India or travels in China? I'm interested to know whether our reflections meet yours.
Well, I had a question about topics or the confines in which you work as writers. Not just, you mentioned areas of conversation, topics which wouldn't be talked about in China. I'm sure in India as well, there are clearly things which are taboo, and I know that you're probably also tackling some of those. But are there any areas which you decide you wouldn't want to explore, or are there any areas which you haven't done so far, but which you're beginning to turn your thoughts towards? And what are the nature of those kind of parameters or confines in which you perceive?
Is that to all three?
It's just if anybody's got thoughts on it.
Keeping it brief, when you're writing about India, certainly for me, there is always a question of representation, because it is such a diverse society, and you're talking about caste, you're talking about class, gender, and the question always comes up, do you have the right to tell this story? Because you're a man. If you're writing in English, you're immediately, you're a privileged man. So you have, you're basically a bundle of privileges, and do you have the right to tell a story that goes beyond your class or beyond your experience? And I think this is something that as a writer, you kind of constantly have to grapple with, because you also have to be extremely aware that you're kind of taking up space, that other people are not being allowed into, because you have access to publishers, you have access to events. So you have to be very careful about the stories you tell and how you choose to tell them. And certainly for myself, I think what's been really key is to always be aware, or to have the humility to know that there are stories that you just cannot tell because you lack the experience, and there are other people who will tell those stories much better than you. And I think that's really important to always bear that in mind. But, I mean, having said that, I also believe that, no one should ever be told that you cannot write about this. I mean, as a writer, you should be free to be able to write about anything, but it's recognising your own capacity to do it justice, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think how you do it is probably the most important part. And, I mean, I don't really have any taboos about subject matter, because I'm not yet constrained by, whether a publisher will print it or not. I'm still kind of under the radar in that sense, so that I can say I'm going to write about child rape in an orphanage, which is a story I've covered as a journalist, which didn't make it into publication because it was just too controversial for that magazine to publish, and that wasn't a quite high leading Indian magazine. But as a fiction writer, I think I would write that story, and I would definitely be able to try to find the publisher. But, for me, when I read the sort of writers that come before us, like Manto, for example, and there you're dealing with a writer who straddled partition, whose subjects are the prostitutes in the Bombay slums, who understood what it might mean to be raped because there was just an opportunity there for that to happen. And he was, a young man who thought the world of himself, writing in a time of great violence, and he does it so beautifully. So I think how you do it is the thing that makes the difference.
I like to feel there's nothing I can't write about, but maybe there's some things I can't publish. I could aspire at least to write about every kind of person, every kind of point of view. There's some things I might decide I don't want to publish it because having written them, I might say, well, people might misinterpret it in some way. It's particularly when it comes to writing more on the coming book, actually. I was writing about Islam, for example, what the different kinds of Muslims. If I write something and I think that people might interpret it as very offensive, I might decide not to publish it, which is a problem with sort of censorship there. In the case of China, I might write something which would upset the Chinese government, but I don't think they really care about me that much,
Your books are, your work, I'm assuming it's only available in English,
it's not available in China. I can't imagine that it would be, not in mainland China, I can't imagine it would be translated. It's not that offensive, people write much more offensive things, you know, but nevertheless, it wouldn't be, it wouldn't be translated and published in Chinese, so you can buy it in English, you know, within China. You can go up into the Beijing Bookworm, a very good bookshop in Beijing, and there it is, you know, on the shelves. Yeah, there are some things which, but I try not to send when I'm writing, or I try not to think about that. I try to say, yep, I can write everything, and maybe it won't work out. Maybe I'm just not capable of doing it. Who knows? Maybe I decide it shouldn't be published, but that's another story. But I aspire to have no limits.
And then you have to risk a regime, you know.
Yeah. Well, saying. I mean, in terms of, you know, I'm not going to get executed or put in jail. And the worst that could happen is they could not allow me to China. I mean, you know, in the case of Muslims, they might, you know, from, I don't know. But I'm not going to, yeah.
Just a quick question about Syrian research. Yeah. I know you haven't written the book yet, but is there anything you can share that's interesting that you discovered by interviewing the refugees? Like that we might not know, or like,
oh God, there's a huge amount. Well, like plenty of breaking stereotypes. Yeah. I'll tell you something I spoke to, this is actually, I don't know why journalists really so much work within stereotypes. I have a friend and she's a journalist. And then she went off to interview some of the, you know, refugees who were arriving actually in a Munich railway station. And I read the article she wrote, and I also, she told me personally, you know, kind of among the things she heard. The things she told me are so much more interesting than the things she felt she put in the article. So, for example, she met a family of, it was Kurdish refugees, they were fleeing because their town, basically being ISIS had sort of conquered their town. This is like, you know, a pretty standard story you've probably read somewhere. But she interviewed one of the, you know, a young man, a teenager, and said, so what's your story? And he said, well, you know, ISIS came to town, and I thought they were so cool, these people in their uniforms, and I wanted to join them. And my elder brother basically grabbed me and threw me on a truck and says, we're getting out of here. But she couldn't put that in the article. She didn't, that kind of thing. She didn't, I mean, isn't that more interesting? The kind of things you normally read. But of course that happens. Of course that happens. And that's the kind of thing that certainly I could write about from a fiction point of view.
Is that where you see the role of, you know, fiction writers or just writers in general, people who aren't journalists, come in, that so much of journalism is kind of constrained by the editor who knows what the audience kind of wants, and
that's one of the things.
Word limits as well.
Well, there's so much. Journalism is a very constrained sort of format. In particular, one thing fiction writers do, obviously, is get inside people's heads. You really can try and work out what people are thinking, because they're making it up, but you can try and imagine it. And journalists are not allowed to. You can't. You can only, if somebody says something, you can report it. You can't try and sort of work out the complicated thoughts. And that's, you know, the great tradition of Western fiction, really, is getting in, since the novel appeared, is getting inside people's heads.
Yeah, I've done a bit of work with Syrian refugees in Zaatari refugee camp, which is about 8 miles from the Syrian border,
mm-hmm.
where a Syrian refugee who's quite a famous TV star, he's sort of the equivalent of Jim from Neighbours across the Middle East. He went into Zaatari to do a production of King Lear and Hamlet with the children of Zaatari. And they spent sort of 3 months rehearsing this thing, and in my academic life, I followed that process right through. And the difference between what the children got out of it, what the children are actually like, which bits bored them, which bits were interesting for them, was so different from how it was reported. Because in the kind of media eyes, they were doing Shakespeare, and that was really interesting. It's like, oh, look, refugee children do Shakespeare, and they get so much out of it because they represent, you know, what they've lost. But actually, you know, on the ground, the little boy who played King Lear, he's basically the king of the camp now, because he still has the paper crown that he used in the play. And they were just so keen to carry on doing theatre because they're totally bored of playing football. And, you know, they're just children who need something to do which empowers them, which is a terrible word to use in these circumstances, but it gives them something to do that's not about receiving culture. It gives them something which actually fulfills a basic human right, the right to participate in a cultural life. And I think that's the difference between what fiction can show us or academic writing can show us and what journalism can do in that circumstance.
You're nodding.
Well, I was just thinking, because the other thing I think fiction can do is it can deflect what appear to be the main arguments of the day. As an example, the political situation in India at the moment is so polarised. It's a little bit like the US with the Tea Party Republicans and the Democrats, where all culture is also viewed through that same prism. So you're either on one side or you're on the other. And everything is reduced to this, yes, but who do you support, X or Y? And I mentioned the story about the women in Punjab preaching Christianity, converting Hindus and Sikhs. So on a headline level, on a journalistic level, this would be a story about Hindu fundamentalists versus Christian fundamentalists, and you know who's winning the battles for people's souls, and you know it becomes a numbers game, and that's the story, the way it would get spun. Whereas, you know, certainly with fiction, I was much more interested in the family life of someone who is in that position, because to me, I'm not interested in how many Christian converts there suddenly were in this village in over an X period of time. I was sort of interested in what is it doing to a man to know that he's been abandoned by his wife, who's now going around villages preaching in favour of a new god. You know, what is that doing to his psyche? And when she comes to his village, will he go and hear her speak? You know, and that's kind of what this story is about. And these are the sorts of things that you never hear in when you read newspapers or on these sorts of reports. You know, it all gets swept up in the kind of the mainstream camps of the day. So I think that's something that fiction explores really well.
Got time for one more question? Anyone got a question? Well, I might just ask a completely generic question to end on, since we have been talking about short stories. I know some people say that short stories are that's all on our smartphones and our concentration supposedly not great, that short stories are the answer to that. Other people say that actually the novel is what modern people want because it's the only time they really do switch off and get engaged. It would be great to hear all three thoughts on this. Are the short stories going to have a moment? Are they having a moment?
Well, who knows? I think they're actually in America, they're much more of a moment than they are in Britain. I think short stories are wonderful. I think, what can I say? I think novels are also wonderful in different ways. It's just, I love, you know, when the mind switches between the two. When I'm writing short stories, somebody tells me something, I think, oh, there's a short story in that. So when I'm writing poems, there's a poem in that. And when I'm writing novels, yeah, that could be a little scene in a novel, some I think to myself, and the world becomes, it's wonderful to read. I think the great thing about novels, they go on a long time, so you can live in them, but you know, you're in that soap opera. And also, they're kind of baggy a little bit, which is kind of fun, you know? You're not that constrained. Things happen you don't particularly expect. You know, sometimes a chapter will drag on for no particular reason except the author's having fun writing it and the reader's having fun reading it. And short stories are much more, they're more shapely, they've got a little form to them. They're lovely little things, you can put them on a mantelpiece, you know. They're lovely little things, people patronising my short stories since I write them. But they're kind of, amazing, sort of beautiful, you know, objet d'art and things. And they're both wonderful in different ways. It's not one, not, I mean, read both, you know, or is that or read one this year and then next year. You know, this year get rid of short stories, next year get into novels or whatever.
Well, I think, you know, Indian family, you know, you say I'm writing fiction and they're like, oh, right, what are you writing? Short stories. Okay, good, I'll read those. Oh, I'm writing a novel. Okay, good, you'll win the Booker Prize. So there's a kind of, like, difference there between social expectations and family expectations.
And I think when you're on a short story panel, you know, people do kind of say, oh, our short story is having a moment. And it sort of feels like we've all got to agree that they are having a moment, because, you know, we kind of all have to sort of be in sympathy with each other and stuff. So, I mean, I don't know that they're having a moment. I just think it's something that people like to talk about. But it's certainly extremely difficult to get a collection of short stories published, as it's always been. But I do vehemently disagree with this notion that short stories serve this purpose in our lives where, you know, because we're on reading on the hop, you know, where we can be on a train and read for, half an hour, 45 minutes, and that's a perfect time to read a short story. I think, actually, certainly I read short stories with far greater intensity. I need a quieter space. I need, I don't need bustle around me. I think it's such an intense experience reading a good short story that, to me, it just flies in the face of this kind of narrative that we're hearing. You know, we're reading it on these devices and we can do it on the go. I never read short stories like that. You know, I'm much more probably likely to read a novel with a bit of drift in it in that way rather than a short story. But you know, reading is so personal, so.
Well, thank you all three for coming tonight and sharing with the audience what you've been up to, the lives that you captured. We do have some copies of some of the short stories available. And please join me in giving them a round of applause.